is now one of the prestigious IITR systems in universities, rather, in India. He was a gold medalist from that university. He is now the Secretary General of the International Water Commission on Irrigation and Drainage. He has, for over four years, served in the water resources four decades served in the water resources sector. He's a member ex officio, additional secretary to the government of India in their APEX technical organization dealing with water. He's a member of the Central Water Commission. He's coordinated the Indian government's multidisciplinary high-level task force on interlinking rivers, which, when you think about it, is a very big project. He's been president of the he was president of the Indian Water Resources Society, member of the Technical Advisory Committee for the World Development on Report 3. He's was inducted as into the American Academy of Water Resource Sciences, given the distinction of lifetime achievement, and he was inducted as an honorary diplomat for that organization. He's published over 100 papers in prestigious journals in this area and has clearly made a very large impact. So I'd like to introduce Dr. Gopalakrishnan.
Thank you, Donald, for the kind words of introduction. Well, rightly, this session immediately on the heels of the last one is trying to also concentrate on water management for food security. And we are now trying to descend to country levels, and two large countries, which almost is the home for half of world population currently, and also having as much as over 50% of irrigated agricultural lands with them, they are going to be covered. And first, I am now trying to take the Indian example. My task is going to be much more easier, given that we are following the excellent session that was preceding ours. So what I am now going to do, trying to link the food security with water, and almost more or less in the same trend of the global needs, that which is asking doubling the existing level of food production. In respect of India too, we are looking for something of the same order. The current production levels are about 230 million tons per annum, and it might be necessary for us to take it to around 450 to 500 million tons by 2050, the population, which is about 1.16, is likely to be of the order of 1.6 to 1.8 billion. And for them, addressing the needs as well as nutritional demands, we require that much. This particular slide is very important to understand the settings. In the morning, Bart, in the earlier session, Bart covered about the density of population in the different parts. We are now talking about this particular zone, which you could see, which has got the highest population density. Population engaged in agriculture, too, is quite significant. And they also have the contributions for GDP from agriculture, which is sizable. So that is the setting, and it is quite a challenge compared to what you see elsewhere. The Asian scenario itself is a challenging one, and in particular, the South Asian scenario is much more challenging. There are three aspects. These things were covered in ICID's task force paper in 2004 itself. The important pillars, availability, stability, and affordability, these three things, as we saw it at that time, would ensure food security, and these still remain so. We have been adding more pillars, but at least for stability, three is a must. And for the availability, both land and water is going to play a crucial role. and stability. We have to see how far this could sustain year after year. And affordability is also an important question. We saw in quite a few cases, despite the availability of the food, there are a few who are still not able to get what they require. I would go in the same order and start with availability. And when it comes to the land resources, rightly, about 18% of the global population is in India, with hardly about 2.4% of the world area. And still, it is a country with a large quantum of rivers, water resources, as well as potential agricultural land. So these are the assets for the country. At the same time, there is a very population density being high. It is a great challenge. And what the world is trying to face now, India had been trying to face since the last three, four decades. There are about 13 major river systems, and every river system like Gangetic as well as the other systems are heavily populated. And these, apart, the country is endowed with a very good groundwater too. You find the hydrogeological map, the rich belts which are having quite a bit of, abstractable water. However, the pressures on irrigated land, the use of groundwater for agriculture, had already strained, and the red areas, which you see here, are the unsustainable abstraction of groundwater is giving some great concern, and it cannot go on as such for long. So this puts some difficulties, and there is a rapid decline in the water levels due to these high abstractions, and you see quite a chunk of lands. It is going to cause a future problem. Severe environmental degradation is a big challenge that we face. So what's important to note is that the groundwater as a panacea for the future problem solving, especially be it the huge demand due to urban growth, which you see, all these circles are all sizable urban demand centers, and the agricultural demand, groundwater, we have to be careful if we want to put much of our reliance on that. For our country, the percentage dependence is something of this order. The surface water which are utilizable is of the order of about 700, and the groundwater is about 430, of which about 65% had been abstracted in respect of surface water and about 60% in respect of groundwater. So how prudentially we abstract the balance or develop and abstract the balance in respect of surface water is going to matter, and groundwater, there has to be a slower pace. The high population is going to take our demands almost to double, or even with the introduction of the best practices, especially in irrigated agriculture or agricultural water diversion, we still anticipate about 60% increase. There are two scenarios which are postulated. That's why you find two figures. And in respect of other sectors like domestic, it is three times or 300%. It is a rapidly growing industrial economy, so it is also going to ask for about 400% of the present levels of demand. Energy sector is also going to ask. So more or less, what we saw in the last slide, the utilizable water, we find that this total of 1,123 billion cubic meter would be almost the demand by 2050. So what's required is the best practices, and it is in respect of almost all sectors, and in particular on agricultural sector, because of the percentage that agricultural sector is now taking, it would gradually reduce to from 85, 86 to only 74%, and this is asking for the best managerial practices in respect of agriculture. So irrigation in food security is a must. While we do have sizable rain-fed agriculture, and it contributes nearly about 60% of the present level of food requirements. Future, on dependence on rainfed, we have a lot of problems because of the monsoon type of climate. That I would try to cover in the rest of the slides. And the inevitability of enhancing the available utilizable water, even by long distance water transfer, that is what I am trying to bring out in the rest of the presentation. Now, we move on to the second part, that is the stability. While I said that we do have a good amount of surface as well as groundwater, what happens after 2050 would be agitating some minds, but it is anticipated that the steps that are being taken to control the population, there would be a fair success by 2050, and the population could stabilize at the level of about 1.8 billion by 2050, when the global population would be of the order of 9 billion or so. So having said that, we move on to the stability aspect, the Asian monsoon is becoming more and more a problem with what we see, essentially due to not only the climate variation but also the climate change, and this heavy monsoon dependency and rain-fed agriculture and agricultural food that comes out of the rain-fed lands is a thing that should be critically reviewed. And in case one has to overcome that, what's the present levels of storage, be it green water or blue water or virtual water? That is the second aspect. So growing dependency on water secured for food production, this will be my second part. And agricultural, unirrigated land agriculture is about 40%. And in fact, rain-fed agroecological share about 60% of the net sown area, nearly half of cereals, two-thirds of cotton, 90% of pulses, millets, 80% of oil seeds and horticulture comes out of unirrigated areas. And we have to almost see the best out of this. And we do not want to depend for more crop production except by improved agricultural management in this area. And in case we have to enhance the production, we have to convert some of these unirrigated lands to irrigated land, which is going to ask for more water, which would either come from whatever we have developed by improving the practices managerial or by new development. There is a national program of rain-fed authority which is also trying to see how to augment the productivity levels from the rain-fed areas, and this is where watershed management, rainwater harvesting is being given a lot of importance. But what is more important is that the conversion of rain-fed lands to irrigation assumes importance because of that doubling the levels of present production. If it is not done, more rain-fed would be asking for encroaching the forest land and so on, with all the uncertainties associated with the climate change. So one can't eliminate looking into the possibility or options for more dams, and that's where the slides that I would try to indicate where we are is very important. The levels of storage that has been created in the different river basins is seen here. This is 80 days annual flow, 40 days, and in some cases it is hardly 2 days of the 365 days flow that is stored. Somewhere in the peninsular part, we do have about 220 days flow captured for moderated use in the non-rainy days. The rains are for about 4 months or just 100 hours, and this capturing by dams and storages is important, and it has not been done to the levels that would be asked for with the future population growth. We do have, rightly it was brought out in the morning presentation, about the simultaneous occurrence of droughts as well as floods with the same monsoon. And this is very unfortunate in a country that is blessed with, overall, if you see the average, it would look quite all right, but when we come to the regional levels, we get into problems. The extreme conditions are becoming an yearly phenomenon these days, and nearly quite a bit, 40 million hectares out of 168, which I was indicating, is flood-prone. Drought is also impacting about 51 million hectares. So the future strategies have to address these things effectively, and that's where the storage, large and small, would assume important. Wide disparity in water-related development and usage between basins we obtain as of now. We have quite a few close basins. That's how transfer of water over basins for long. This is in the anvil, but it has not taken off. We have to look into it, and this would be one of the important actions in the coming few decades, maybe two, three, to ensure water security for food security. And sustainable water transfer, why it is still a dream is something that agitates quite a few of us. The country has already seen possible links. They are about 30. And in a recent independent study by a private group, most of you might be knowing about the work of the Water Resources Group. It came out with a report in 2010. McKinsey and quite a few others had tried to take over this task of independently doing assessing. And in this too, you find some of the supply and demand and surplus areas and moderate the size of the gap and severe gap, these things are coming up. This is more or less in line with the studies that the government did before evolving a program of water transfer over long distances. Each of these lines are trying to take the water from the water-rich areas down to water deficit areas where there had been sizable agriculture. This part is semi-arid zone where we can get more production and that way ensure food productivity to the levels desired. The amount of benefits that one gets from these are quite sizable. These are the new opportunities that are available for enhancing the global food production and Indian food production too. About 22 million hectares can be augmented by the part of the links in the upper India or the northern part, which we call Himalayan river system, plus so many other things. In this peninsular part too, there is a scope for about 13 million hectares, and that way both put together, an enhancement of about 35 million hectares may be possible in the coming 3-4 decades to cope up with the future needs. This is apart from efficiency improvement and the enhanced food production that is possible. This is a very sizable big scheme, and it will ask for a huge investment. Some sort of projections are here, and it also gives, amongst other things, lot of opportunities for job creation and livelihood. Because you see that it would provide almost all sectoral demands for different things, including the production sectors and employment generation of sizable thing. So this is a thing that the government is trying to look at. And the independent analysis that I just mentioned that came from McKinsey, which was also trying to put at different levels the cost of recovering water by different measures, it had tried to bring it here. This is that national river linking, which is here. And the extreme costs are for desalinization and so on. So in this graph, it is a sort of a cost curve, which is of interest. And this supply measure faced a steep marginal cost curve. This part of the scheme would be somewhere here. And this is desalinization, the small scale. These are all quite attractive. But the scope to contribute for the food production, enhance the food basket, is somewhat limited. So gradually, under financial scarcity situation, one would move from here to here. And this is somewhere here, and probably this plan might be receiving increased attention. So the basin transfer is really a meritorious candidate, and that is going to, in future, try to help. In fact, the McKinsey report simultaneously also depicts the Chinese situation. and the basins in India, how different basins have either surplus or deficit, and these two comparisons, probably I am sure my colleague Gao is going to tell also about the long distance water transfer that the Chinese are trying to do. Some aspects of the cost, the total annual cost for the combined set of supply and agricultural levers is approximately $6 billion per annum, which is $6 billion, just more than 0.1% of India's projected 2030 GDP. This is by the McKinsey. Our own costs are slightly differing. Implementation, institutional constraints, impact on labor markets, all these things are going to matter when we think of the grandiose scheme. GDP or other economic matrices are excluded from these projections, and the earlier projection was about this much. Here it is slightly less. Execution might itself take 2-3 decades because a lot more has to be done to look into critically the environmental impacts, and those studies are going on how best to enhance the environmental thing. Having said the availability and the stability in food production levels, the affordability is very important. India has the problem of still having a large chunk of people, especially in the rural part, they are affected by poverty, and when the food pricing also happens, the hike in food prices of 2008, quite a few suffered terribly. And this is where securing food for underprivileged is becoming quite important. And India has been experimenting with a lot of measures unique to that situation. Many of you would be admiring on one side the shining India. It is the largest democracy. It has withstood the global recession, not with much impacts as compared to the rest of the world. And the present level of GDP growth is also quite substantial, about 7-8%. In fact, it crossed 8%. We have a real alert, vigilant society, more younger people, vibrant with also our media is terrific. You can't do things wrong. They would haul you up. India had been able to have sufficient it was self-sufficient, it is self-sufficient, and it might not move from this avowed goal of self-sufficiency at the country level. But the other side of it is also unfortunate. It is a starving India when 1/5 of the population of the globe, nearly 220 million people, is in India. More than 27% of the undernourished also is in India. And 48% of children under 5 are underweight. So a country in which many states are at loggerheads with their neighbors for water that is getting scarcer day by day. It is a mini globe. We do have all the advantages as well as the problems. One side, a rapid industrial growth, especially in industry as well as in computers, and the use of computers is growing quite a bit. The pity is that even though we have all this shining India thing in the last decade, we were more successful in reducing poverty in the pre-liberalization era as compared to what we are now. The Indian economy, though it is trying to yield very good results, it is not trying to impact the rural as much as it does for the urban. The government interventions and other piecemeal efforts by NGOs, it couldn't dent and redistribute the wealth of the rural poor to make them equal partners. And the problem of hunger goes beyond poverty. Sufficient all-round improvement in nutrition and health are still at a distance because now basic requirements are also not being met, and then to also balance it to nutritional requirements as was projected in the morning session is going to be the subsequent step. The causes aren't necessarily attributable due to the inadequacy of available grains. You would find that we did have enough, and in fact some grains are wasted. So I am coming to the fag end of my presentation. This is what the media was trying to present as late as 6 September 10, and that is where one has to see what to be done. But there are very good examples. In the state of Tamil Nadu, in down south, there had been very good measures to improve the public distribution system so that every family is in a position to get the grains that they require. And there is subsidy, and these grains are almost distributed at peanut prices. Can it be replicated to all India level? Universalize, but there are others who argue that this is not a desirable thing, and this type of subsidy should be as early as possible be done with it. So these are the problems. You may have enough, but if the distributions are not done effectively, that could also impact the food security at different levels. So almost with that, what I would try to conclude, the Tamil Nadu example, and Tamil Nadu had like my other example in China, Dujiang Via, maybe pronouncing differently from what you say. We have a grand aniket that was built about 1800 years back. This was diverting water, and there was ample food security. And Tamil Nadu was a place where there was enough food, there was dance, music, prayers, welfare, and this is the celebration of 1000th year of a temple in that part. So sustainability of food production is possible by seeing some of the examples there, and we would see likewise from Dujiang Yang example of China. Thank you very much.